This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black and Latino activists come to grips with tensions between the two communities over jobs and prejudice. A new report shows that, the way things are going, it will take 75 years to cut the U.S. prison system in half, and even then, it will still be the largest in the world. And we'll have a report from the courageous journalist Eva Bartlett on Syria.
But first, gun control advocates often despair at matching the political clout of the National Rifle Association, one of the nation's most powerful lobbies. Historian and activist Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, however, is not surprised at all that the NRA wields so much influence. She's author of a new book titled Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, which explores the deep roots of U.S. gun violence in the centuries of genocide and slavery. Dunbar Ortiz explores the historical ignorance of the corporate media, especially in their coverage of mass killings. Typically, when the media cite the grim body count of past mass killings, they ignore the long history of massacres of Blacks and Native Americans.
This is always pretty disturbing when they talk about the greatest number of people killed. Some of the media has started saying in modern times. Of course, I don't know what modern times exactly refers to. I know when the event took place at Virginia Tech, this was only a few miles from the horrific massacres of the Native people at Jamestown, and they were celebrating the 400-year anniversary of Jamestown. The Queen was there, George Bush. They were all there celebrating a few miles away. This Korean-American kid is killing all these people on campus. And there was this kind of disconnect because it's almost like a double screen on the television of covering these two events. You know, it's what Gore Vidal calls United States of Amnesia. And, of course, the horrific massacres, hangings, lynchings of African Americans under slavery and Jim Crow. And, you know, I am thinking of the work that community does in Chicago all the time, the African American community and many of them women, really trying to deal with the gun proliferation. Guns make themselves very available in these communities. And it's never mentioned that they're a part of any kind of effort to make a change in gun violence. It is a peculiar phenomenon. The first was that Texas Tower shooting of the Marine veteran in 1965. Then it was 12 years before these postal shootings, going postal and workplace shootings. 65 was, of course, the height of the Vietnam War, so here's this Marine who hadn't been in combat but who had been trained as a sniper getting up and doing his thing during the war. So I think these wars also produce this militarism and violence that we see. But there's this also this period of deindustrialization, which had a lot to do with the very successful organizing in Detroit and Chicago, industrial organizing, the DRUM, the Detroit Revolutionary Union Movement. And I really think the deindustrialization was very much to do with this successful organizing that came out of the Black Civil Rights Movement, and corporations just started leaving, and the post office started privatizing at that time. So this is where you first saw these shootings. It just started happening on a regular basis during the Reagan administration. So I've tried to, in this new book, Loaded, try to figure out the socioeconomic, political, setting for What Is This? And I come up with, mainly, it was the Civil Rights Revolution, that the marker was the desegregation decision of the Supreme Court in 1954. This was a earthquake for the white republic, because if you think about it, it was really nailed down as a white republic, white men in charge of everything. There were even discrimination at very high levels against Jews at that time, so it was mostly white WASP men. And Jim Crow locked down the South, and people leaving that, going and then being segregated and ghettoized in cities, they think of the nostalgic 50s, well, they mean before 1954, you know, when it was, as it should be, as the Constitution intended, a white republic. So that's when you began to see these armed nationalist groups coming back up again. The Klan is interesting to follow because they were the slave patrols before the end of slavery, and then within a few months of the end of the Civil War, the slave patrols had put hoods on, and so they were illegal for a time. And then when the occupation ended, they took the hoods off and became the police and the sheriff. Police violence creates what's called gangs. Not that difficult to argue that the police cause that violence. The wars, I think, put violence in the minds, but there's just also this history of violence that is not acknowledged, and the continuing situations of colonialism, settler colonialism, of Native people having no real guaranteed right that they can, from one day to the next, still have their stripped down reservation lands from their original lands, and this never-ending police violence against young black men, and then the border, the anti-Mexican, that's always been in the mix ever since they started invading Mexico when it became independent. But I think that we have to grapple with some of these issues and come up with analysis that makes sense. Of course, I'm a historian, so I'm biased that how important I think history is. But I don't think it's just important for its own sake. It's just being reenacted all the time, you know, with violence. These mass killings are phenomena from 1965 to the present. They do account for a very small number, I think 2% of the actual gun deaths in the United States. But they're so vivid and dramatic, and they're kind of like warnings, siren calls to look beyond the obvious thing of NRA bribing congressmen, which is really ridiculous. You know, the NRA has a base. They're the only completely legal membership-based white nationalist organization in the United States. And that's pretty scary. It has a mass base, and they don't have to bribe anyone. They give some gifts, but their contributions. They have a $300 million a year budget. And to me, that sounds like a huge fortune, of course, but it's just peanuts compared to the oil, gas industry, pharmaceutical, the amount of money they put into lobbying and owning congresspeople. So what they do is, these unpaid volunteer devotees in NRA chapters throughout the country actually just swarm any candidate in person in every congressional district, in every state. I look at them as almost a model of organizing, you know, how we should be organizing, because they're very effective. And I don't think any kind of gun control is going to change the situation. I think these, as long as there's this militarism, no society that is so militaristic, and we don't even recognize it, you know, that it's militaristic by intent. These militias that are provided for in the Second Amendment were continuation of the self-organized, self-regulated, unpaid militias of white settlers who were in the forefront of, you know, simply going in and burning Native villages, burning their crops, and driving them out until, you know, over time, a huge resistance to that major war started occurring pretty quickly in every colony that got formed. But that was the trajectory all across the country. So it's like this unrelenting 300 years of war. I have never been able to find anyone who's identified a single day in United States or its colonial period before it, 150 years, when there wasn't war against brown people or black people going on, the United States involved, or Anglo-Americans, the settlers involved, in violence and war. How could it not be a violent society? It's almost unique in the world. It's very different from others that had the same history, like Australia, New Zealand, Canada. The same kind of genocidal policies and attempts to eliminate the native, and much worse than Australia, actually. But there are several factors. They all stayed in the Commonwealth, so there's a different relationship of nationalism. It's not as extreme, white nationalism, or it doesn't take that form. And the other is that they did not have chattel slavery. There's a unique aspect to the United States that built capitalism upon the accumulation in the Cotton Kingdom, not the standard classical Marxian concept of an industrial revolution or, say, what happened in Britain. But even in Britain, that prior accumulation was from the colonies, not just an internal domestic thing. So we don't even, you know, have a context historically in the United States for dealing with the fact of colonialism and how that structures the state and how violent colonialism always is.
Yes, in terms of slavery, all of my adult life, I guess for the past 50 years, I've been hearing about how this country is coming to grips with its history of slavery. And yet very few Americans even know that Native Americans were also enslaved by the millions, especially in the early colonial years.
The first 88 years of Spanish colonialism in Mexico and up into, you know, they were up into what is now New Mexico, Arizona, California, they actually outlawed enslavement of the Indians. The church wanted the Indians for slaves, for labor, because they were money-making operations of the different orders of the Catholic Church. So there was a struggle, and the church won the Indians. So this was Bartolomé de las Casas' famous descriptions of the horrific treatment of Native people and slavery, very much like, you know, descriptions of African Americans in slavery being transported. They were transported from eastern Nicaragua, Honduras, down to Peru, you know, which is the length of the transatlantic slave trade, the people, the Natchez people of the Mississippi Valley. The Spanish took, they were farmers, you know, they gathered, they may have been up to a million population, and were deported and taken around the Cape of South America and around to Cusco, you know, to work in the mines. That was the slave trade, and that was outlawed in 1588 with the law of the Indies. So then the church had control of the slaves, and De las Casas, who's always called the friend of the Indians, recommended that to replace that slave labor, that they begin African slavery. So African slavery was introduced on a large scale in Spanish and Portuguese-controlled areas. So the British were latecomers to North America. But what's interesting about this, after institutionalized, it was decided upon there would be one caste of people who would be enslaved, and the native people would be eliminated under settler colonialism, the Anglos. They did have slave trade in New England, but it very quickly turned to the Indian slave trade, and that was mainly to sell in the Caribbean sugar colonies. So there was, you know, really a century of fusion between enslaved Africans and enslaved Native peoples. It's one of the least researched and understood topics in this recent book that came out called The Other Slavery that got a lot of attention. I think it lacks that aspect. It's not either or how many, but the fusion of the slave trade. And Native people were early put into it, but then it turned to almost exclusively African slavery, of course, in the English colonies, and genocide for elimination under settler colonialism for the Indians. But that period of from independence of the United States to 1859, I know when I was a graduate student at UCLA, and of course it was just beginning that slavery and black history and very becoming important because of the civil rights movement. There were all these theories, Eugene Genovese and others, said that enslaved Africans in North America, it was such a tight capitalistic system, which is true, that they never revolted. This is, you know, there were all these marooning in the Caribbean and this throughout Latin America. But that's just not true. You know, they're just not calling what happened in the Everglades marooning. First of all, it was Spanish territory, Spanish claimed territory. So they were going into another country. So this is where the Native people, as they were demolished, you know, after independence in the Ohio Valley, they began organizing confederations. Tecumseh was an important one, the Shawnee Confederation. And then all throughout the Southeast, the incursions on the Muscogee people, the Seminoles and Creeks. So they were going into the Florida Everglades and fighting guerrilla warfare, you know, to stay there, but also to really weaken the U.S. Army. So you follow the career of Andrew Jackson that really kind of covers that arc. He's not the single person, but it's his lifetime is spent doing that, first as a Tennessee militiaman driving out the Muscogee people from Alabama, and they then form in the Everglades. So this was a marooning that enslaved Africans could escape. They had a place to escape to, and they really merged as a people. The Seminole Nation is a fusion, like the people, the Garifunos of the Caribbean and the Eastern Caribbean came out of the merging of Native and Black revolts. So I think this is a long history. The Seminole Wars, there were three declared wars, congressional declared wars against the Seminole Nation. They're called the Seminole Wars from 1815 to the last one was 1859. And of course, the Civil War made it unnecessary to try to force them to give over the Africans among them. Osceola, the leader of the Seminoles, when there were negotiations and they said, you can have this, the United States annexed Florida from Spain. Jackson annexed it. So it was no longer a foreign country. So they made this proposal that if you, Osceola, if your people will give over the Africans among you, this can be yours. We don't want it. It can be your land, and we'll guarantee it. And Osceola said, how could we do that? This is our flesh. You know, they were completely intermarried and a people. You know, they were a new people. So they refused that. So that wasn't the only place. There were places in North Carolina where the Tuscaroras and others were still resisting that enslaved Africans could escape to. So that whole history of resistance and insurrections, I think Walter Johnson's book, River of Dark Dreams, his description, his documentation of the marooning in the Cotton Kingdom, he writes that it was like a complete counterinsurgency. Slave owners were involved in counterinsurgency in terms of the marooning in the swamplands, and that it was so unstable. And of course, the former wealthy slave colonies, Virginia and South Carolina, they had taken to industrial production, reproduction of slaves and selling them after the end of the international slave trade, and taking them over. So this was really the development of capitalism in the United States was based on the value of those slaves' bodies as commodities. And Johnson has calculated that the value of slaves' bodies was greater than all other assets in the United States. All the gold, all the land itself, all the cotton, the production, that just the value of the slaves' bodies. And I think that doesn't really get through to people in the United States when they're considering slavery as exclusively a forced labor, because there's all kinds of forced labor in the world, but the actual commodification and capitalization of bodies is pretty unique to the United States, the form of it, and the kind of implied violence of capitalism in the United States. So I think even on the left, where we have great Marxist scholars, they have not understood the specific development of capitalism in the United States, and Marx himself didn't grasp it. You know, this Eurocentrism of analysis of the United States is a problem in every kind of forming a real analysis of the political economy and any kind of strategy that could change things. There have probably been more near revolutions in the United States, the whole labor movement in the world, every holiday, May Day, and International Women's Day, and everything is based on struggles in the United States, and yet they're almost all white, and there's never is slavery presented as a proletariat and slave insurrections as really where you should start with the history of labor in the United States.
That was historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, author of Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment.
In Washington, the Sentencing Project has a new report out summing up the setbacks and the progress that's been made in prison reform. Nazgul Ganjnoush is the Sentencing Project's senior research analyst and author of the report. She calculates that at the current pace, it would take 75 years for the U.S. prison population to be cut in half. On average, the national prison population has shrunk since reaching a peak in 2009. We asked Ganjnoush if she's encouraged by the numbers.
Well, it's encouraging in the sense that until that point, for nearly 40 years, the prison population grew every single year, just unrelenting growth in the prison population. But since 2009, in most years, the prison population has been downsizing. And so that's a testament to the work of advocates from around the country who have been pursuing criminal justice reforms relentlessly, but have been facing a lot of resistance. And so what we wanted to do with this report was to show that we're making pretty good headway when it comes to drug sentencing reforms, but even there, we have a lot of work left to do. But if we really want to be serious about ending mass incarceration, what we've been doing so far is not nearly enough to expedite this, to bring us to justice in any reasonable point, you know, time reference.
And what are the standout states, the states that have reduced their prison populations the most, and who are the laggards?
Well, there are a number of states that have actually reduced their prison populations by over 25%. So there are about six states, New Jersey, Arkansas, New York, Vermont, Connecticut, California. So this is really promising in terms of, you know, we really see these states making meaningful dents into incarceration. New Jersey has downsized by 37%, a reduction in its prison population. In New York, their level of decarceration has been 31%. So that's really promising and exciting. And these are states where we don't see very significant efforts to undo that progress. In other states, the progress is actually in jeopardy because lawmakers are thinking about turning things around. The states that have yet to reduce their prison population include Kentucky, South Dakota, Nevada. These states have continued to increase their prison populations. Even, you know, they're in the minority. There are a total of eight states that have yet to reduce their prison populations. And the majority of states are beginning to downsize their prisons, but not nearly at a large enough rate.
And what are the forces that are leading to these prison reductions? Are politicians recognizing that the prison system is evil, or are they just trying to save money?
You know, I think that it's a combination of both and whatever motivation brings people to the realization that we need to downsize our prison populations. On this particular issue, we should be willing to all just work together to get it done. Some people come to this from a spiritual perspective. Some people come to it from direct impact, knowing communities that are impacted and seeing the cost of mass incarceration. So the particular mechanics by which this has been achieved has been by reducing sentences for drug violations. So, for example, scaling back the Rockefeller drug laws in New York, also by increasing rates of parole so that people can be released earlier from their confinement, and reducing parole revocation. So if someone doesn't make it to their parole hearing on time, you know, because they're not able to catch a bus, because of delays like that, that would not result in their reincarceration. So those are some examples of the kinds of reforms that have helped to bring about the progress that we've seen so far.
Have you noted a change in the environment as it relates to prison reform since the ascension of Donald Trump to the White House?
Well, Donald Trump and his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, have really stalled things at the federal level. So whereas previously there had been great momentum to bring about sentencing reform, so sentencing reform meaning that we're scaling back excessive prison sentences, especially at the federal level, these are largely for drug crimes. Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions are primarily interested in prison reform, what they call prison reform, which means improving, increasing programs in federal prisons, but actually not necessarily promising to fund that kind of increase in programs and not reducing sentences. And so those kinds of, you know, moving in that direction and putting the brakes on sentencing reform means that we're not going to be able to achieve very meaningful levels of decarceration in the federal prison system, where nearly half of the people serving time are there for a drug offense. So that should be in some ways one of the easiest places to bring about sentencing reform. When we look around the country and we just look at people serving time for drug offenses, there's been a reduction by about 25% in the prison population when it comes to just drug offenses. But overall, there's been a lot of reluctance around the country. There's continued momentum to bring about sentencing reforms for drug offenses, but we still have yet to see big steps to take, you know, any really meaningful steps to reduce sentences for other kinds of crimes, in particular for violent crimes. About half the prison population is there for a violent offense, largely for assault, robbery. If we really want to end mass incarceration, we have to reconsider how long we're sending people away to prison for those kinds of crimes as well.
You say that some prison reformers are calling for a 50% cut in the prison population within 15 years. But you've calculated that at the rate that things are going now, it would take 75 years to cut the prison population in half.
That's right. And so there's a gap between our aspirations and what, you know, the actual reforms that we've been able to achieve so far. So what we're hoping to do with this brief is to just give people context and help to increase the urgency of what we need to achieve here, to let folks know that not only at this point do we have to defend the reforms that we've achieved in terms of scaling back prison sentences and increasing reliance on alternatives to incarceration so that people don't get sent to prison in the first place, but we also need to do these things much more quickly and on a much broader scale. So when I mentioned to you that a number of states have reduced their prison populations by 20% or more, most states are reducing their prison populations by somewhere between, you know, 1 and 10%. And so these are the kinds of states, especially in the larger states like Texas, for example, where there's been some movement in the right direction, but it's not nearly enough to undo the injustice of mass incarceration.
To put this in perspective, the Black is Back Coalition demands that prison populations be rolled back to the level of 1972. But that would require letting go 4 out of 5 prison inmates. And 1972 was not that good a year in terms of prison. Back then, people were talking about the horrific use of prison
prison of mass incarceration as a weapon against the black community. And yet we'd have to release 4 out of 5 prison inmates just to get to that level.
Thank you for mentioning that. The brief that we've done examining how it would take 75 years to cut the prison population in half would still mean that we have a ways to go beyond that in order to really end mass incarceration. So half of where we're at now is really not the ideal place to be, but we thought it was a useful exercise to think about just how long it would take to get to that goal. We would still have a lot of problems in our prison system, racial disparities, the quality of prisons. You know, there are increasing interest in recent years in the United States from criminal justice officials and reformers to look abroad at what other countries are doing and look at, for example, Scandinavian countries, where being sent away to prison is considered punishment in itself, and everything else that happens to you there in some of these institutions is intended to rehabilitate you, to really help you get back on your feet when you're released. So even if we cut our prison population in half, we would have farther to go, we would have racial disparities to continue to address, and we would have to think about what are we using prison time for. If being away from your community and family is enough punishment, what should we be doing during the time that we're keeping people away to make sure that when they return, they're better off than when they started?
Yes, cutting the U.S. prison population in half, what would that result in? The United States being at the same level as Russia and China, plus racism in the prison remaining?
It would result in us having a higher incarceration rate than our peer countries. And so definitely there would still be much more work to do.
So what class would that put the United States in if the prison population was cut down by half? Who would be our peers?
Our peer then would be countries like Brazil. We would be below the level of incarceration somewhat of countries like Rwanda, but we would still be about 3 times higher in terms of our level of imprisonment compared to Canada, France, much higher than Germany. So we would still have a long way to go, but we would not be quite the level of outlier that we are right now.
So we would still have a long way to go 75 years from now if the pace continues as it is.
Certainly. And so really what we need to do if we want to end mass incarceration is look at how quickly we built up the prison system and the dramatic rate of growth, where in some years the prison population was increasing 10-12% in 1 year, whereas in recent years, as we've begun to downsize prisons, we've never exceeded a rate of about 2% in prison reductions. And so it's been incredibly difficult to achieve the reforms that we've achieved, but we really need to have everyone educating those around them so that policymakers realize that there is an environment, communities that they're responding to want significant decarceration, and they want it now. They don't want it in 75 years.
That was Nazgul Gandnoush of the Sentencing Project in Washington.
On this Friday, March 23rd, some of the strongest currents in the Black and Latino movements will come together at New York City's Holy Rood Episcopal Church. The event is called Breaking Down Laws and Prison Plantations, Mumia, Migrants and Movements of Liberation. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with one of the organizers, Johanna Fernandez, of the campaign to bring Mumia home.
Our attempt on Friday, March 23rd, is to bring together two movements that have historically, unfortunately, seen themselves perhaps in opposition to each other, especially in the last 40 years. And that is the movement mostly led by African Americans in this country to end prisons and against hyper-incarceration on the one hand, and the movement for immigrants' rights on the other. What we see happening in the last 20 years is that immigrants, especially beginning in 2006, have been increasingly criminalized by the state in ways that are very, very similar to how African Americans have been criminalized historically in this country. So your audience may know that in 2006, Congress passed the bill H.R. 4437. What's important about that bill is that it legislated literally stop and frisk for Latino-looking people who the state assumes are undocumented in this country. And it essentially expanded the incarceration in what are known as detention centers of migrants without papers. And it also essentially funded on a mass scale the building of a wall along the border of Mexico and the United States, but also its militarization. So not unlike African Americans, people in this country from Latin America who are undocumented, and even those who are documented, find themselves in open prisons in this country, in their neighborhoods, wherever they go in the community. So this event, to get right to it, is going to really address the question of whether or not there is common cause between Latino immigrants and African Americans, in part because we know that there exists an enormous amount of anti-Black sentiment amongst Latinos, and there's an enormous amount of frustration and probably displaced resentment on the part of African Americans toward Latino immigrants for allegedly taking away jobs. So is this truly the case? And what is the basis for these two communities coming together, not just to fight against the repression that both of these communities are experiencing in terms of incarceration, but also in terms of their shared class interests?
No doubt. And as we know, divide, agitate, and rule has been a central weapon in the white supremacism arsenal. And Mumia Abu-Jamal has been emblematic of this kind of solidarity over the decades with his writings and radio commentaries and the way that he's able to link struggles throughout the country and globally. With that in mind, could you give us an update as to what is Mumia's state of affairs, both health-wise and in the courts?
Well, I'll just preface my answer to this question by saying what I didn't say previously, which is that it is our attempt to link, in fact, the movement to end prison plantations in the United States to the movement to free political prisoners, and in particular Mumia Abu-Jamal, and the fight for immigrants' rights. So on this question of where we are in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, we have an unprecedented opportunity to free Mumia, in part because the courts are looking at a grievance that he presented to the courts, which essentially claims that he did not get a fair hearing when he appealed his case initially quite a number of years ago because his prosecutor in the DA's office was also the judge who reviewed his appeals. And the judge at the time was Ronald Castile, who was previously the elected DA of Philadelphia. And as we know, you can't be in this country both prosecutor and judge. And that was the case in the 1990s up until the current period, because Judge Ronald Castile has presided over the Pennsylvania Supreme Court all of these years, and he has reviewed, not just in Mumia's case, but in hundreds of other cases, the appellate claims of people and prisoners and defendants he prosecuted as a DA. So the courts are hearing this issue right now, and what we are expecting imminently is for the DA's office to find all of the records in its office in which Castile is featured opining or deciding on or discussing the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, but also that of others, so that the judge who's hearing this issue right now can determine whether, in fact, there was bias on the part of Ronald Castile when he was reviewing Mumia's appellate case. So we are essentially engaged in a struggle to publicize this incredible opening, but also to pressure the courts to finally do right by Mumia, because we know that Mumia should never have been imprisoned, and we know that this judge, who was awarded Man of the Year status by the Fraternal Order of Police in the 1990s, we know that he was hell-bent on ensuring that Mumia was executed during that period. So there was, in fact, bias. So that's where things are, and the next court date in Mumia's case is, the next big court case is on April 30th, and we're asking people to join us in Philadelphia to support Mumia and to demand his freedom.
And Breaking Down Walls in Prison Plantations on the 23rd will be kicking off a Freedom Fighters Weekend in New York with the 20th anniversary of Jericho following that on Saturday, and then a march for Mumia on Sunday. Could you just outline for us a bit more about what Breaking Down Walls in Prison Plantations will entail, who will be participating on that night?
Yes. So this is, in fact, the kickoff of a weekend of events and demonstrations around political imprisonment. And the speakers for that evening are Mariam Kaba, who's a prison abolitionist, organizer, educator, and curator. Pam Africa, the beloved Minister of Confrontation of the MOVE organization, will be joining us. Also, Niall Fort, who's a young minister, organizer, and a PhD candidate in religion at Princeton University. He will be joining us. Also, the attorney, one of the attorneys of Mumia Abu-Jamal, Samuel Spital, who's also part of the Legal Defense Fund, is going to be giving us a report on Mumia's current legal status. And also Father Barrios is going to be speaking. Now, Father Barrios is very important because he's the minister of the Holy Rod Church, which is the church where this event is being held. And Holy Rod Church is an official sanctuary in New York City that is one of the churches in the city that is officially protecting and offering sanctuary to undocumented immigrants who are being persecuted and pursued by ICE. So he's going to be speaking, but we also have another person speaking, Marlene Navas Ramos, who's a graduate student at the Graduate Center here in New York, and she is part of Critical Resistance and has also been working with ICE Free NYC. That's the organization that has been fighting against these ICE raids, wherein the state pretty much goes out into our communities to pick out undocumented immigrants and essentially throw them in prison en route to their deportation. So those are the folks who are going to be speaking. We're excited about this conversation. Part of what we need to do in this period is to really bring our struggles together. And the question is, on what basis do we bring our struggles together? We believe in the campaign to bring Mumia home that Latino immigrants and African Americans share a history of racism in this country, and that in addition to that, the majority of African Americans and Latino immigrants also share the fact that we are both exploited by capitalism, in fact, hyper-exploited. You probably know, and your audience will agree, that African Americans have been the super exploited class in the society historically. But that ended after African Americans essentially took a stand during the civil rights and black power movements. But this country, because it's a capitalist and imperialist country, had to identify a new class of super exploited and racialized people to do its work. And so part of what we see is that Latino immigrants who are also racialized and who are standing in a very precarious situation because they have to live in the shadows, they've become and have replaced African Americans as the super exploited labor in this country. And so there's an enormous amount of commonality here. There's an enormous amount of education, however, that has to happen because, as we know, Latino immigrants come to this country, and because they are in such a precarious position in part, and because of the own history of racism in Latin America, they look down on African Americans and seek to distinguish themselves as a group from African Americans. And they are oftentimes ignorant about the history of struggle of African Americans and the history of criminalization and demonization of African Americans in this country. Likewise, African Americans are not always up on the ways in which the United States and its imperial quests have rained terror on Latin American countries. And it is that terror that is rained on Latin American countries by the United States that often leads people from Latin America to end up in the United States, not to mention policies like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, that essentially makes trade and business really easy for North American businesses in Latin America. And part of what we see happening in Latin America is that those economies are destabilized, labor is displaced, and people have to eat. So they come to the United States to essentially take jobs that no one else in this country is willing to do. So this is the conversation that we are going to engage. It's an important conversation. It's due time for the conversation. It's been happening already. And it's not an easy conversation to have, but if we're going to win, we're going to have it. So we invite everyone to join us and to continue the struggle.
That was Baruch College Professor of History and African American Studies, Johanna Fernandez of the Campaign to Bring Mumia Home.
Eva Bartlett is a courageous Canadian war reporter who, along with British journalist Vanessa Beely, has exposed the so-called White Helmets of Syria as a public relations unit of Al-Qaeda. The Western corporate media claim the Syrian government is deliberately starving the people of East Ghouta, an Al-Qaeda-occupied neighborhood near Damascus. They said the same thing about Aleppo. But Eva Bartlett covered the Battle of Aleppo and visited the liberated town of Medea and saw no evidence of Syrian government atrocities. Bartlett spoke with the Global Research News Hour about her time in the town of Medea.
When I went there in June 2017, civilians there told me, just like in East Aleppo and just like I'm positive we're going to hear in Ghouta when it's finally liberated, civilians told me, there was food that entered. The Syrian government allowed food. It sent food in, and it also allowed aid agencies to send food in. But we didn't have, we, the civilians, this is them, me paraphrasing them, did not have access to the food because the terrorist factions or the militants, they took food. And they, if they sold it to us, they sold it at prices we could not afford. And when I went to Medea, I saw above a bomb factory that the terrorists were using to manufacture mortars and missiles to fire on the Syrian army and on any civilians below them, because this was in a hillside town. Above that factory was a storage room, which they, one, at least one storage room, where they had kept the food and aid supplies that came into Medea. And there was media. There was Russian media, Murat Gazdiev with RT, and of course Syrian journalist who our media completely dismisses, who went to Madaya in January 2016 and who saw and took photos and videos of food aid entering Madaya, and who spoke with civilians who were protesting the presence of these terrorists stealing their food. But Western media completely dismissed them and ran with this narrative that the Syrian government was starving civilians in Madaya. So, as I said, the same thing occurred in Aleppo, and when journalists finally went there, Syrian independent journalists, Russian media, unfortunately, the only Western media that I'm aware of that actually deigned to tell the truth was surprisingly Reuters, and they have a clip interviewing civilians saying the terrorists stole our food, and they show a storage of food boxes. Just yesterday, I believe it was, Rupti, which is affiliated with RT, reported on food aid going into El Ghouta. And even the ICRC, the Red Cross spokesman, said food aid had been sent in. But in April 2016, when all the media, relying on Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, said that the Syrians or the Russians had deliberately targeted and destroyed, reduced to rubble, a hospital named Al-Quds in the Sukkuri district of Aleppo. And this was used to again vilify the Syrians and the Russians and to call for intervention or a no-fly zone. That hospital was not destroyed. I saw it with my own eyes. And before I saw it, months before I saw it in June 2017, a Syrian doctor I know saw it, and a French man named Pierre Lecor saw it and documented it. So there's no way that it was destroyed and rebuilt. It was never destroyed, but in that instance, MSF relied on whatever nefarious Al-Qaeda or whatever linked source that fed MSF this information. And I suspect that WHO has relied on this information as well. And the United Nations is, in my opinion, deliberately participating in war propaganda. Because I recently wrote an article after I came across this statement issued on February 20th, and it was issued by UNICEF's Regional Director of Middle East and North Africa, and the statement was one of outrage, and it was called "The War on Syria on Children in Syria Reports of Mass Casualties Amongst Children in Eastern Ghouta and Damascus." And so that statement was essentially just blank lines and some words. No words will do justice to the children killed. Now, it did mention Damascus at the end, but obviously the implication was Eastern Ghouta, because that statement then recycled in all the different Western corporate media outlets that were citing claims of 400,000 civilians trapped in Ghouta being starved by the Syrian government. None of these outlets, first of all, can provide sources for their number. Where do they get this 400,000? It could be the case, or it could be inflated, as was the case in eastern Aleppo, where even the United Nations said 250 to 300,000 civilians trapped in east Aleppo, and it was half that number, if not less than half that number, when we finally had access to east Aleppo. So that's question one. Where do you get this definitive statement of 400,000 civilians there? But moreover, why, corporate media, are you not mentioning, and this is a completely rhetorical question because I know, why are you not mentioning the presence of Ahrar al-Sham, Failaq al-Rahman, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist factions in eastern Ghouta? And why are you not mentioning that some civilians have actually been able to flee, escape at their own peril, being attacked, you know, with these terrorist factions bombing humanitarian corridors, as two children recently escaped from eastern Ghouta?
You should be able to have easily access to those who make it to Damascus, no?
Well, so the Syrian and Russians have opened, just like they did in Aleppo, they've opened humanitarian corridors. And it's the terrorist factions within who are not allowing civilians to leave. Mm. And since you asked for my own personal examples, before Aleppo was liberated, I met a father and a man and a woman who had numerous children who had tried a couple of times to escape their area of Aleppo, Al-Halaq, and they had been prevented by the terrorist factions, and finally they and 40 others, one night, while there were clashes between the terrorists and the Syrian army, they were able to escape. And then later on, you know, there's a lot more documentation of people trying to flee and being prevented by these terrorist factions. And that is what's happening in Ghouta. Also in Aleppo, in November when I was in Aleppo, on one of the humanitarian corridors, the Castello Road, it was shelled twice while I was standing there on the road, and five more times after security had told me and the others that were there to leave. So this is clear, and it wasn't the first time. It had happened weeks before, heavy shelling on various humanitarian corridors. Yet the media is portraying the Syrian government as showing no will whatsoever for the to guarantee the safety of civilians. And that's completely not true. The Syrian government and Russians and all the allies are working to ensure the most peaceful solution possible.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.